headlines, Russia says new deliveries of Western weapons to Kiev include French-made armored vehicles, which will only deepen the suffering of Ukrainian people. The death toll from a single day of clashes between protesters and police in southern Peru rises to 17. And thousands of nurses from two New York hospitals go on strike after negotiations over pay and staffing levels fail. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Russia has slammed France and other Western states for their recent decisions to ramp up military support for Kiev, warning that such measures could deepen the suffering of Ukrainians. The Kremlin spokesman has reiterated that Western arms deliveries cannot and will not change anything on the ground. Dmitry Peskov says such moves would not deter Russia from achieving its goals either. Last week, France and Germany announced that they would send light combat vehicles, including tanks, to Kiev to help it fight Russia. Ukraine, which has scored some battlefield successes in the recent months, has asked its Western backers for heavier weapons. Moscow, however, has time and again warned that Western leaders are prolonging the conflict by providing weapons to Ukraine. Peace activist Daniel Kovalik says U.S.-led NATO is pursuing its own hegemonic agenda at the expense of the Ukrainian people.
The U.S. and NATO don't care about Ukraine or the Ukrainian people. You know, people like Senator Lindsey Graham have said that the Ukrainians will fight the Russians to the last Ukrainian. And I think in the end, what really is the truth is that NATO will fight Russia to the last Ukrainian, that Ukraine's being sacrificed on the altar of U.S. hegemony. And I do think that the weapons the NATO is sending will not change the outcome of the war, but will extend the war and cause more suffering to the Ukrainians and Russians alike. I think, sadly, the war will continue into the summer of 2023, and I think the outcome will most likely be that Ukraine will be divided up at least into two parts, if not more, because I think, you know, the eastern part at least will end up as part of Russia. And I think Poland and or Hungary may take parts of the West. I think in the end, Ukraine will not exist as a country in the way that it has. And again, I think that could have been avoided through negotiations, but the West has not allowed it to happen. The problem is Zelensky is not in charge. He is a client of the United States, and the U.S. is calling the shots here.
UK's Prince Harry's tell-all memoir has not just given the British public a sneak peek into the inner workings of the monarchy, but also embroiled the royal household in controversy. Harry's bombshell revelations in the book have drawn backlash from the media, commentators, army veterans, and even the Taliban. That is while a support for the royal family is in decline.
The British royal family may appear to be prim and proper to the public. However, they have faced their fair share of controversies over the years. From the separation of Charles and Diana in 1992, and the famous comment of the late Princess of Wales that there were three of us in this marriage, so it was a bit crowded, to the Megxit when Prince Harry and Meghan Markle stepped down from their royal duties. Now, few years into the new year, the royals are on the back foot. The Duke of Sussex's tell-all memoir, with its bombshell revelations, has turned into a big challenge for the monarchy. Prior to the official publishing of the book, multiple media outlets reported they had secured copies of Harry's autobiography. Among the jaw-dropping claims is Harry's reported retelling of his scuffle with his brother, Prince William, in 2019, his use of cocaine as a teenager, and killing 25 people in Afghanistan when he was a helicopter pilot in the country. He also said he confronted discrimination and neglect from the royal household from a younger age. While Buckingham Palace has kept silent, Harry's revelations have drawn mixed reactions. Some have denounced Prince Harry's tell-all memoir for putting family arguments out there for the world to see. They say Harry's account will be damaging to the monarchy and undermines the king at a time when he is trying to show the institution is modernizing. Others say they sympathize with the sibling rivalry the prince describes and other elements of his experience. The fact is, the British monarchy is by its very nature hierarchical, and this has led to Harry feeling like his spare part. A former royal biographer has said he is perplexed by Harry's memoirs, saying it contains the kind of revelations you would expect from a B-list celebrity. Meanwhile, the royal analyst and biographer of King Charles, Catherine Mayer, has said Prince Harry's book could be the beginning of the end of the monarchy, given the lack of trust in the state at the moment. She said anger over racism, misogyny, and wealth in the royal family can undermine public consent for a monarchy. Survey results over the years show that younger people are less likely than older people to say that it is important that Britain has a monarchy. Indeed, just 14% of under 35-year-olds take that view compared with 44% of those aged 55 and over. This suggests support for monarchy will decline as today's older generation is replaced by younger Britons.
Prince Harry, in his memoir, acknowledges that he killed 25 people in Afghanistan when serving as a military helicopter pilot after the invasion of Afghanistan. Ironically, he stressed that those killings do not embarrass him. The revelation has sparked both condemnations and derisions from different groups.
Revelations in Prince Harry's newly published book include the murder of 25 people in Afghanistan while serving with the British Army in the country. The 38-year-old described killing targets as moving chess pieces, noting that he was not ashamed of doing so. High-profile British veterans have criticized Prince Harry and warned the high-profile admission could increase the risk to his personal security. Retired Army veteran Colonel Tim Collins said the prince's kill count talk was crass, and we don't do notches on the rifle butt. Others said Harry had appeared wrongly to dehumanize those he killed by describing them as chess pieces removed from the board. That's while the Taliban have accused the prince of committing war crimes on his military tour in Afghanistan. Abdul Qahar Balkhi, the spokesperson for the Taliban-led Afghan Foreign Affairs Ministry, described the Western occupation of Afghanistan as a horrible moment in human history, saying comments by Harry is a microcosm of the trauma experienced by Afghans at the hands of occupation forces who murdered innocent people without any accountability. Last year, an investigation revealed commandos in the UK's elite Special Air Service Corps killed at least 54 Afghans in suspicious circumstances during a six-month tour of Helmand Province from November 2010 to May 2011, but the military chain of command concealed concerns. The investigation found that unarmed Afghan men were routinely shot dead in cold blood by SAS troops during nighttime raids during the long war in Afghanistan, and weapons were planted on them to justify crimes. In 2001, the US and its close allies, including the UK, invaded Afghanistan under the pretext of fighting Al-Qaeda. The invasion preceded by over two decades of war in Afghanistan and cost 241,000 lives.
At least 17 people, including two teenagers, have been killed in the latest round of clashes between anti-government protesters and the police in Peru. The toll makes Monday the deadliest single day of protests since they began a month ago. The violence also left 68 people wounded. The clashes erupted in the southern city of Juliaca. Peru's Human Rights Office has urged the police to abide by international standards in using force. The anti-government rallies resumed last week after a holiday lull and have so far left over 36 people dead. The protesters are calling for early elections, resignation of the new president, and the closure of Congress. They also demand the release of ousted President Pedro Castillo. He was arrested after removal from office in December. Brazil's president has condemned as act of terrorism the Sunday attacks on the presidential palace, the Congress, and the Supreme Court. Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva made the remarks after a meeting with leaders of the Houses of Congress and Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. In a joint statement, they denounced what they called terrorist acts and coup-mongering vandalism committed by the rioters. The raids were carried out by thousands of supporters of former President Jair Bolsonaro. The aim was to overthrow President Lula da Silva's government a week after it took office. In response, hundreds of people have held protests in Sao Paulo demanding punishment for the rioters.
Totally absurd. It's the worst moment in our history after the 1964 coup that established the dictatorship. I think everyone was appalled by the images we saw in the National Congress. The fight is now to support a government that was democratically elected, and we are not going to leave the streets.
The raids on Brazil's institutions are being compared with storming of the U.S. Capitol in 2021 by supporters of former U.S. President Donald Trump. But Brazil's communications minister says the attacks in Brasilia were more severe. Authorities have so far arrested at least 1,500 people and have vowed to bring the organizers to justice. Condemnations also continue to pour in. One of the latest came from Venezuela, where the president called the rioters neo-Nazis and denounced their assault on public institutions. Iran's foreign ministry has also expressed concern about the developments in Brazil and called for respect for the rule of law. Over 7,000 American nurses in New York have staged a strike in protest at harsh work conditions and staffing policies. Striking nurses rallied outside two hospitals in the Bronx and Manhattan. They waved signs in support of hiring more nurses and better pay. The walkouts forced health centers to move patients and scale back other services. The strike came after authorities failed to reach an agreement with the nurses' representatives. The COVID pandemic has exacerbated nursing shortage in the U.S. Many nurses have left long-standing jobs for higher-paying short-term assignments. Earlier, we were joined by our U.S. correspondent Colin Campbell for more detailed understanding of the striking nurses' working conditions.
Well, the strike was organized by the New York State Nurses Association. This is a group of nurses that have come together that advocate their own interests. And what nurses are saying is that they are stressed out, quite frankly. They are overworked and they are tired. So approximately 7,000 nurses went on strike in New York, and they called to the attention for some of the subpar conditions in which they've been forced to work in. What does that include? Well, you have nurses that are caring for several infants at a time, when usually it's regulated that when a baby is born, they are paired up with a nurse, meaning one-to-one, very specialized care. Well, now nurses are saying that they have to attend to 3 to 4 babies at a time. This could mean administering medication, making sure that they're calmed down, making sure their diapers are changed. And as you can imagine, these nurses are working overtime or working much more than they should be working. And they also say that because of the lack of nurses that some New York area hospitals have failed to hire, They are working even more when it comes to emergency room situations, and that could mean subpar care for patients. Instead of someone coming in and getting attentive care right away, they may be delayed, or maybe a patient who's already been admitted may have delayed medication coming to them because that nurse is busy attending to someone else. So what they're saying is they need more nurses. They want hospitals in the area to hire more people and to make pay more competitive so more nurses will be attracted to those jobs, and that their jobs, the nurses who are already there, their jobs will be a bit easier and they can do them with a bit more quality.
China has stopped issuing short-term visas to South Koreans in response to the country's imposition of travel restrictions on Chinese travelers over COVID concerns. China's embassy in Seoul says the restrictions by South Korea are discriminatory and would be readjusted after Seoul ends the measures. South Korea's foreign ministry, however, says the limitations are based on science and objective. The ministry also says that they are communicating with Beijing on the issue through diplomatic channels. Seoul imposed the constraints last month. They include visa restrictions, testing requirements, and some flight limits. There has been international concern over the surge in COVID-19 cases in China, but Chinese media say many parts of the country are already past their peak of infections. Gazans have been driving a convoy of ambulances along the border fence with Israeli-occupied territories to protest the regime's import restrictions of medical equipment. A banner on the ambulance reads, "Preventing the entry of medical devices means the slow death of Gaza patients." Gaza's health ministry has warned that the Israeli blockade on medical machines puts patients' lives at risk. The ministry said the current equipment is in bad shape and, quote, crumbling. The protest was staged after Israel refused to allow the entry of X-ray machines needed to treat patients in the Gaza Strip. Israel imposed a tight blockade on Gaza in 2007. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, if you remember, we discussed the liberation of Khorramshahr and the events related to this great juncture in the history of the Islamic Revolution and the eight-year holy defense. In this episode, we are going to dwell upon Imam Khomeini's ideas about the status of women in society. Stay tuned, please. One of the important issues which had occupied the minds of combatants and thinkers during the struggles against the despotic regime of Shah in Iran was the clarification of the status of women in society. Imam Khomeini was always asked by journalists on the position of women after the victory of the Islamic Revolution. The father of the Islamic Revolution always tried to clarify the Islamic view and approach towards individual, social, and political rights of women. He considered women as the core and axis of the family unit and believed that if woman succeeds to achieve high grades of knowledge and spiritual and ethical values, she will be able to train children and keep the family climate more successfully. This will lead to an advanced society. The Imam was of the opinion that women's presence in family and their impact on men and children determines the course of society and the movement of mankind toward perfection and sublimity. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, strongly condemned the instrumental look of the Shah regime to women, which had trivialized them into the means of pornography and promiscuity. He would always support individual and social freedoms of women, but never agreed with turning them into the tools of meeting the carnal desires of libertine men. Imam Khomeini always called for serious and active participation of women in various scientific and cultural arenas. He said, "The Islamic culture is oppressed, and you ladies should be engaged in scientific and cultural fronts like men." Imam Khomeini's unsparing support for education and progress of women in scientific fields was quite clear in his family and personal life. While many traditional and religious strata were opposed to education of women, the Imam permitted his wife to acquire religious sciences and modern sciences. He would even help Ms. Saghafi in her courses. Ms. Saghafi says, "After receiving the diploma of the sixth grade, I went to Badriya High School and studied grade 7 there. And 2 months after starting grade 8, I chose a private teacher for French language. When my father left Qom for Tehran, I studied Jama'ul Muqaddamat with him for a while. Jama'ul Muqaddamat is the preliminary book for the students of seminaries. After marriage, Imam Khomeini would teach me. After a while, he told me that I needed no teacher as I was talented." Imam Khomeini strongly defended women's participation in political and social scenes. He maintained that the victory of the revolution was the result of the efforts and self-sacrifices of ladies. However, he believed that women's social and political activities shouldn't become superficial and ceremonial. In view of this, he vehemently opposed the special bill during the Pahlavi regime, which would give women the right to vote. As a matter of fact, the Imam was not opposed to women's right to vote. He rather considered the move to deceive people, as in those days, even men had no real right to vote, and it was only the nominees, dictated by the Shah, who could enter the parliament. Imam Khomeini would say, "Islam intends woman and man to grow. Islam has liberated women from the miseries of the era of ignorance. Islam wants to preserve women's status and respect. It wants to give position to woman to end being a tool." According to Imam Khomeini's thoughts, after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, women's social and political rights were recognized in the constitution, and many women have participated in various posts for the past decades. Presently, a notable number of the MPs are ladies, and over 60% of university students are girls. In the first years of the Islamic Republic, some backward and short-sighted persons disagreed with women's social and political participation. But Imam Khomeini stood against them and promoted the issue while preserving women's status and dignity. The Imam's wife says, "One day I heard that the Imam had sent a message to the Iranian nation and stressed that it should be read out by Ms. Maryam Riazi on TV. There was an argument on the reason for Imam's emphasis. Everyone would say something till Ahmad said, 'The main reason is to remove the problem that had occurred on IRIB.' The IRIB president says that some of the anchors were ladies and Ms. Riazi was one of them who had been an anchor since pre-revolution. She was the best female anchor. The social atmosphere in those days was against employing female anchors. But as male anchors were needed in the battlefronts, the IRIB was in shortage of anchors. Imam Khomeini had heard the issue and said that women can do the job."
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
It's described as the most right-wing cabinet in Israel's history, and sure enough, it is living up to that description. The coalition cabinet of Netanyahu is taking extreme steps against Palestinians and its institutions, from ordering the flag of Palestine to be taken down, to sanctions against the PA, to the storming of the Al-Aqsa Mosque to Palestinian prisoners and their conditions. Well, the list is rather long. All of this is happening in a matter of a couple of weeks' time since the beginning of 2023, when the cabinet members were actually sworn in. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at all these extreme moves, also deemed illegal, and look at what this means for the future of Palestinians and Palestine. First, let me introduce our guests. Mohsen Nafi, human rights activist, joins us from Houston, Texas. Also joining us is Brett Jonkers, historian and journalist, who joins us from Hasselt, Belgium.
The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. I will start with you, Mohsen Naqvi, and let's take a look. It was rather easy to actually come up with the questions because there have been so many, on so many fronts has this right-wing extreme cabinet members to have gone out and to have made good on their pledge of cracking down on different Palestinian issues. So let's start with issue number one, in no order of importance. And this is the issue of withholding money. Millions of dollars, as it was announced by the finance minister, in tax revenues will be withheld from the PA. And the reason they gave was because of that UNGA vote, of which it was recommended by the PA for the for Israel to be referred to the ICJ, International Court of Justice. Of course, this is a big deal for the Palestinians who are already striving hard with their daily lives in occupation and under an apartheid regime. Tell us what you think about this move by the finance minister.
Well, this is what was expected out of this new cabinet, this new right-wing fascist cabinet. And they're doing exactly what they had propagated during election time, that they will really try and enforce as much force as they can upon the people of the West Bank, especially the Palestinian Authority, and that's exactly what they're doing. $570 million of tax deductions have already been made since 2019 to 2022, and the $40 million that they're reducing right now that they have claimed that they're making is actually money that is used as a stipend for the innocent Palestinians in the West Bank who've been either killed or who've been injured by the Zionist regime. So this is clearly an attempt to further weaken any kind of power that the Palestinian Authority has within that area. And it is certainly an attempt to weaken any kind of resistance that the West Bank is enforcing upon the Zionist regime, and to really weaken them psychologically, especially financially as well. So it is that attempt. New Year has started. The cabinet just came in power. This is the kind of trend that they're setting. This is the tone that they're setting to the new year, that we're not here. We don't advocate for a two-state nation. We're here to weaken you. And this is just, it's very symbolic as well. And it's an attempt to retaliate to the fact that the UN has referred the case of Palestine to the International Court of Justice as well. So it is an attempt to also silence the PA.
Sure. Well, you kept mentioning the word trying to weaken. I wish that word was used, or that approach was used by this right-wing cabinet and its members. But let me ask you, Brent Yonkers, what you think of the statement made by the Israeli finance minister on this topic, where he said, as long as the PA encourages terror and is an enemy, what interest do I have in helping it continue to exist? Adding, the PA will have to decide if it wants to continue existing. You see, there's a difference between trying to weaken the PA in this case or putting it into the question of its existence, which sounds like that may be their objective, is it?
Absolutely. The entire concept of a two-state solution, as is so often loudly trumpeted, of course, by the West in particular, but also by countries that often claim to be for a negotiated solution, and in the past has also very often been the official line taken by the Zionist government itself, this two-state solution is a lie, and it has been a lie since the very beginning. All the way back to even when the Oslo Accords were signed in the 90s, there is absolutely, when you really look at the facts that have existed since then, you can see that the Zionists were never planning at all to abide by the rules, by the agreements that they themselves forced the Palestinians to sign and to agree to. What they want to do, what Zionism wants to do, what Israel wants to do, is nothing less than the complete eradication of Palestine as a nation. Not necessarily by exterminating all Palestinians, but definitely by subduing them and by forcing them to exist either as second-class citizens in their own country or by forcing them to basically leave the country, by ethnically cleansing the land from the Palestinian population. So when the finance minister of the Zionist entity says that he is basically threatening the very existence of the state of Palestine, or of the Palestinian Authority, as it is often called, This is basically a threat that cannot be taken lightly. And of course, now he says, okay, if Palestine wants to continue to exist, they have to abide by the rules that we set out in Tel Aviv, and then they will continue to exist. But we know Israel has been doing this since 1948, that they constantly keep pushing the lines of what is socially acceptable. They keep pushing the borders, keep pushing the envelope of what they demand. Originally, they demanded just a nation for the Jews to exist in Palestine within the 1948 proposed treaty by the United Nations. Then they went further, occupied more land. And now they have been, since 1993, they have been occupying illegally areas that even Israel recognized as being Palestinian. And now we're talking about even pushing even further. And they're basically talking about putting forces in Ramallah and completely demolishing any semblance of Palestinian statehood and Palestinian autonomy.
Well, they're going based on a map of what they want to do, a shot list, if you want to call it, because it's rather in quick succession and in rather warp speed, if you want to call it that. And most of that, we just move on to the next topic, which is prisoners. Now, there are a couple issues over here. One, the far-right minister, Ben-Gavir, has scrapped a rule allowing lawmakers to visit Palestinian prisoners. Now, I guess he's going back to some older protocol from what I'm understanding here, where a lawmaker from each faction is going to be allowed to visit the prisoners. First of all, why do you think he's zoomed in on the prisoners? And what do you think about this law that he, at this point, has scrapped?
I think the focus for the prisoners is mainly because of the attempts that the brave prisoners in these jails have made to leave and to escape from these jails. That's one reason. Another reason is that this is another way to pressurize the Palestinian Authority, to show them who the real boss is, to show them who really is in power. It's an attempt to really weaken the Palestinian Authority, and I agree with what you said, not just weaken, but to literally exterminate the existence of the Palestinian Authority, and with that, the agreements and the accords that were signed with the Palestinian Authority as well. But this also kind of goes on to show, and this is also a lesson for the Palestinian Authority, for the PA, that to have any hopes for a two-state solution, to have any hopes to be able to work with the Zionist regime, were false in the first place. The call for a one-state solution in which Christians, Jews, and Muslims can live together was always the right stance to take. And now, with this new regime, it's the real motives of the Zionist regime are really unleashing, in which they don't really care for a two-state solution. Anyone who claims that they do it's a false claim in general. And this prison issue is an extension of that exercise to really weaken and finish whatever empowerment that the PA had.
Indeed. Well, there's another issue about prisons as a whole, Brent Yonkers, and it came to light when Ben-Gavir visited. Ben-Gavir, we keep talking about him, but it seems like he's at the forefront here. So that's why I keep bringing his name up. He visited a new prison called Nafha, if I'm pronouncing it properly, of which he said that I'm visiting this new prison to make sure that the Palestinian prisoners are not living in conditions that are comfortable, that doesn't suit a comfortable environment. Now, this is what's interesting. Let me see if I can get a quote from him on this, of which, according to one particular piece of news, it says that he wants to ensure that the murderers of Jews are not getting better conditions as a result of the construction of new cells. I'm not too sure what to respond to that, which is what I'm asking you. First of all, the whole idea of a new prison, doesn't that show the weakness of the cabinet or Israel as a whole, that it has to build a prison because it's imprisoning Palestinians, of which, what, Israel breaks international law, but yet Palestinians are the ones that suffer? And then for him to come out and say that about the prison conditions, what do you think?
I think there are a few very important words in that, and very importantly there is the concept of killer, that he's talking about the killers of Jews. He's not talking about murderers or terrorists in general. He's talking about people who he considers to be killers of Jews. And this is because Zionists, and especially nowadays, ever since the rise of Likud, this pseudo-religiously sort of justified Zionism, they consider Jews quite literally to be superior human beings, or even above the concept of human human beings. And in consider Palestine.
Hold on to your thoughts, Brett Yonkers. We're getting cut off intermittently, so we're going to get right back to you while we fix that. So I'm going to come to you, Mohsen Naqvi, on the issue now of flags. And this was another eye-opener in the long list of these actions that are shocking actions, to say the least. Again, Ben-Gvir ordering the removal of Palestinian flags from public spaces. That in itself is really, truly shocking, I'm guessing. Of course, your reaction matters. His reason, he says, it's an act in support of terrorism. And he says the flags needed to be removed by what he calls the occupation police and also soldiers, because additionally, it's a threat to public order. What do you think?
Well, this is exactly what was expected from this new cabinet. This was exactly what was expected from a narcissist like Ben-Gvir. He's someone who the Israelis even aren't a huge fan of. This is an individual who has attacked the local police for not taking enough action against Palestinians. So before he came to power, he clearly said that we don't want any Palestinians in the West Bank. He clearly said that even Israelis who are in support of Palestinians, we don't even want them in the West Bank. And it is quite clear that these are the steps that are being taken. I mean, removing flags from the West, from that area is exterminating and finishing the actual identity that the Palestinians have. If cabinets like these will remain to stay in that region, the Palestinians will lose the very identity that they have. The Palestinian flag is a representation of their struggle for freedom. It's a representation of their culture and the right to freedom. And really to hit on that is also a plan to provoke the Palestinians to retaliate and react. And it is quite
very important
obvious
point
that the resistance forces will retaliate and they will respond to these acts of crime, because they aren't just an act of crime within that region, but they are also a violation of their accords, their contracts, and the UN as well.
Sure. Okay, hopefully, Brent Yonkers, we have a good connection with you. If you can go ahead with your statements prior, if you can go ahead with that, please.
Yeah, I was pointing out that by the minister's statement, referring to the Palestinian prisoners as killers of Jews, I think that's a very important point, because we have to bear in mind that the Zionists, and especially the pseudo-religiously justified Zionists that exist in the government now, they have this existential view of the world, of this conflict as a sort of almost spiritual existential war, in which they see Jews as a superior race and Palestinians as an absolutely inferior race to them. For people like Ben-Gvir and in general, the Likud and the religious right in the Zionist entity, if you can call them religious, for them, this is not just a conflict between two states or two nations. For them, this is a sort of existential issue. What they want to do is they want to push on for a form of completely exclusionary settler colony of Eretz Israel, as they call it, Greater Israel, to occupy as much land as possible and to completely get rid entirely of what they see as these inferior goyim, these non-Jews that live in the land that they claim as their own. And that is why, for the minister, it was so important that Palestinians are not, quote-unquote, comfortable in prison. They are not, in his opinion, they shouldn't just be imprisoned. They should be dehumanized. They should be mistreated on purpose in order to have their dignity as human beings taken away, because they are considered to be the enemies of Jews and standing in the way for this sort of Jewish exclusionary racist state that they want to found for what they consider to be the superior people.
D. This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Last week, or maybe a little bit longer, I'm not sure, but roughly about a week or so, Mohsen Naghvi, we had the Al-Aqsa violation that took place by, guess who, Ben-Gvir, who stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque, of course, and that really brought a lot of reactions. It was, I'm not going to say surprising, because there should be that type of reaction, but in the volume and the manner that it came through, based on a date or 2 days after that, of which it culminated in a UN meeting, it points again to another important topic that the minister felt had to be addressed. And it even is said that it went against Netanyahu's warning on this, whether we can believe that or not. But he did storm the Al-Aqsa Mosque, even though the UN meeting did not, even though it convened, but it did not do anything. It did not come out with a statement condemning Israel in terms of a resolution. Not that even that matters, but at least the effort could have been made there. So when you take a look at the different violations, not violations, but the Al-Aqsa violation and the other points that we just talked about, I'm guessing this is not a thing where they sit down and say, okay, so today I'm going to go to the Al-Aqsa Mosque, or let's talk about Palestinian flag removal. This has to be a systematic train of thought that's being executed in rather quick speed. Are we looking at the fact that they want to move ahead real quick with trying to eliminate the Palestinian identity and, in turn, Palestinian foothold in their homeland?
Well, I think these acts, these provocative acts, will only make the resistance forces stronger. And when the resistance forces will become stronger, their foothold within that region will increase and not decrease. So this is clearly a calculated mistake that this new cabinet is also making. And it's quite believable that Netanyahu must have warned them not to storm the Al-Aqsa Mosque, because it is a grave mistake. The kind of reaction that was that the international community gave to this act was overwhelming. All members of his forces united and gave out a clear statement that Jerusalem, that the Al-Aqsa Mosque, is a red line. And if that red line is crossed, there will be severe retaliation. The reason why they're taking these extreme steps, the reason why they planted an extremist fascist like Ben-Gvir in that position, which had never happened before, which has happened for the first time, is because for the first time they're seeing resistance forces similar to Gaza within the West Bank. They're seeing that Palestinians in the West Bank are reacting are resisting in different ways. This is all a way to put that pressure on local Palestinians. This is all a way to somehow get a provocation out of them so that in an attempt to exterminate them from that region so that they can have a Zionist state like they had all this planned. But it's quite impossible. I think all of these attempts will fail. The resistance forces will become stronger, and they will answer to these provocations in force.
Brett Yonkers, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, prisoners, removal of Palestinian flags, also looking at, and for lack of time, we couldn't get into how he has also barred the construction permits to the Palestinians. I think what is happening is that you're having a situation where, based on one particular analyst, since I'm not one, of what is happening on the ground, is that the pressure that's being exerted, it's like a pressure cooker situation that's already compounding a very tense situation on the ground, where these ministers are pushing for an explosion, okay, and all the issues here that we discussed are pointing to that direction. And then the question that is asked is, what this explosion is going to look like, nobody knows. Is that a correct assessment? And if there were to be an explosion, what are we looking at in terms of a reaction coming from the Palestinians?
Yeah, well, it's of course hard to see to say in advance exactly what is going to happen, but I believe we're definitely looking at a sort of new third intifada situation. And I think important is when you indeed talk about the Zionists really putting up the pressure and blowing this to a boiling point, the question is why? Why would they take all this risk when they're already basically in power? And I think it's important to know that despite all their boasting, there is a big existential fear that exists across the Zionist entity, which has been expressed by top intelligence officers such as the former chief of the Shin Bet, whose name I have forgotten, unfortunately, a couple of years ago, who said that demographically speaking, the Zionists are quickly running out of the demographic power within Israel itself, let alone within the Palestinian territories, quite simply because of the fact that they're running out of basically Zionist settlers and they're not reproducing quickly enough to really demographically take over the Palestinian population. And they are faced with the problem that if they just leave things the way they are, the Zionists are afraid that eventually the Palestinians will quite simply outnumber them massively to such an extent that they can take their country back. So the only thing they can do now, in their opinion, is basically to resort to extreme amounts of violence in order to really escalate the situation into total war, and then hopefully for them, in their opinion, hopefully their military superiority in terms of technology and weaponry will win the day. Uh-huh. However, in reality, I think we will see when this third intifada breaks up, when the forces of resistance really take over in Palestine against the forces of appeasement that have ruled since 1990, we will see in the end, inshallah, in the Palestinian victory.
We'll see. Time will tell. Thank you so much, Bert Jonkers, historian and journalist from Hasselt, Belgium, and Mohsen Nahfi, thank you, human rights activist from Houston, Texas. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Batakwai and the team, it's goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Ata, the host of this program. We have a very special guest speaker for today's program, Sheikh Karimi. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Today we want to talk about the text of the Holy Quran, and is it so that most of the references and addresses in the Holy Quran are regarded to men in contrast to the women? Is it right? And if it is so, why?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Answering this question, we need to take into consideration a couple of points, and hopefully, all together we can come to a complete answer to this question. First of all, it is not true to call the Quranic discourse as masculine, in contrast to feminine. This is not the case, because when the Noble Book of Quran is talking about virtues, about their spirituality, about intellectuality and potentiality of men and women, the Quran talks about human beings, and it doesn't distinguish between the gender. So we can claim that the dominant discourse in the Quran regarding these issues is beyond gender, has nothing to do with any certain gender. For example, let me share a couple of verses in this regard. In chapter An-Nahl, verse 97, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم من عمل صالحا من ذكر أو أنثى. Whoever acts righteously, whether male or female, وهو مؤمن, should he or she be faithful, فَلَنُحْيَنَّهُ حَيَاةً طَيِّبًا. We shall revive them with a good life. وَلَنَجْزِيَنَّهُمْ أَجْرَهُمْ بِأَحْسَنِ مَا كَانُوا يَحْمَلُونَ. And pay them the reward by the best of what they used to do. Now, interestingly, in this verse, first of all, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala explicitly mentions that مِنْ ذَكَرٍ أَوْ أُنْثَى. So, you're talking about iman, faith, وَهُوَ مُؤْمِن, and عَمَلَ صَالِح, righteous actions.
That's right.
And the fact that the reward is hayat tayyiba, good life. And the reward in the hereafter. So this is a basic principle that in this regard, there is no difference between dhakarin aw untha, man or woman. But the point is that in this very verse, again, some of the words, attributes, and
The verb forms.
Exactly. And also the pronouns are in masculine form.
Yes.
وَهُوَ مُؤْمِن. Allah says that مِنْ ذَكَرًا أَوْ أُنْثَى, male or female. But then the pronoun is masculine. وَهُوَ مُؤْمِنٌ فَلَنُرْحِيَنَّهُ. Again, a masculine pronoun. Which means that such pronouns have nothing to do with the issue of gender. I will talk about this point later. But now the point is that when it comes to the, basic points regarding the fate of human beings, regarding the spirituality, intellectuality, and the reward in the hereafter and the punishment, there is no difference between man and woman.
And is it true that the number of the references to the word, we can say men and women, are the same in the Holy Quran?
Yeah. According to some statistics, when it comes to the words like rajul and imra'a and so on and so forth, they are the same, there is no difference in this regard. And also we have some verses talking about al-insan, which means human beings.
Yes.
And for example, Allah said in chapter 18, verse 4, لَقَدْ خَلَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ فِي أَحْسَنِ تَقْوِيمٍ. So here,